going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Hey, John.
Hey, guys.
So they did doing a couple of those things. I know you talked to a couple of NFL coaches like Andy Reid when you were at the owners' meetings. What did they all say on how you help Jaden Daniels in year two?
So there's a few things. One, it starts with Jaden, right? Like, one thing we know, and I think one reason why everybody feels pretty good about his progression is the work he puts in. So if you don't have that, the rest of it doesn't matter, right? And then it depends on who else you talk to. Like, I talked to Brandon Bean about this, the GM from the Bills, because they had Josh Allen. How do you build on that? And a lot of it is, like, you protect him. And some of that protection is getting, you know, building a strong wall in front of him, but also, you know, showing him, going through plays and showing, okay, here's where you could have saved yourself a hit, you know, throw the ball here. And I think Jaden got better with that throughout the season. You know, there are things that, one of the things he's going to work on, like you talk about footwork and all that. And this is one thing Dan Quinn talked about. Well, he has his quarterback, one of his quarterback coaches is Ryan Porter. That's what he specializes in footwork. Now, some of what he does is introducing more different styles of drops to his game. And he's worked with them on that for many years. So that way you could have a three-step drop, but take a different three-step drop to kind of toy with the defense a little bit so they can't time up how they're coming, like how they're reading the play. If you're a quarterback, you see a certain drop. Like maybe there's a quick three-step drop, you know, or versus a, you know, different style of a three-step drop. It's clearly a more advanced method for a quarterback, and not everybody's going to get this. Jaden has always worked with this. You know, he's worked with this guy since he was like 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. So he's has a handle on that. So that's another way to develop that game and just, you know, get more around him, etc. But yeah, it's interesting because, you know, obviously defenses are going to be studying him and he's going to be studying them and they're playing tougher defenses this year. So you want to make sure he continues to progress. I do think protecting him is the number one thing. And because there are some things like, you know, they run a lot of no huddle. So defenses will study that. Like, how do you then adjust? But I think the other thing that people came away with is that Cliff Kingsbury did a really good job with this group last year. And there's a lot of confidence that he'll continue to evolve the offense with Jaden.
Yeah, one thing I found interesting in the article, you talk about sack percentage and pressure percentage.
Right.
And you do point that Josh Allen improved big time in those categories. What did you see, you know, particularly end of the season there with Jaden Daniels?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember some of the numbers with him down in the last part of the year, but it got, if I remember right, it got better. I wrote this a few weeks ago, so I apologize. But it got better, and I think he got better at some of the time. Sometimes the sacks for him were running out of bounds, just like it was in college. Like you run out of bounds and it's 0 yards, but it's considered a sack. And so I think like those are some things you take into account. But I think like what happened too, I didn't feel like the offensive line was as solid later in the year in the run game as well. And so I think that contributed to some things. But I felt like he got, and they felt like he got better with getting rid of the ball, and you know your completion percentage is going to go down in that regard. But if you're saving a sack, then that's okay.
JK, did anything in the in the off-season acquisitions in free agency or trades that make you scratch your head at all, or were you pretty comfortable with everything they did?
I
was really good. I was really good with the Debo thing. I love that pickup. And then Tunsil is one of the best at his position, so I love that too. But I don't know. Just getting your thoughts on that.
Yeah, for sure. And I did actually had something. I think it came out yesterday about like how the free agency acquisitions impacts maybe what the direction they go in the draft. And so I think some of the things I liked, first of all, the Tunsil and Debo, like Debo, it's a fifth round pick. Like I think he's going to be worth that.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
And Tunsil, like you said, you're building that wall. I don't think they're done building that line. And I think, you know, that is step one. They wanted to get a premium left tackle. I mean, this is where it goes back to what that article, like build the wall in front of him, continue to protect him, and don't force him to run as much as he had to last year. So I love that. I think the one thing that everybody's curious about was Javon Kinlaw.
Right.
And just not so much that they signed him, but the deal. Now, the deal, people look at, you know, it's an average of 15 per year. Well, he's not counting 15 this year. It's $7 million, a little more than $7 million on the cap this year. Like that's not bad at all. You know, where the cap is gone. Next year it would be like 18. So if he doesn't produce, then it's like, okay, you're living with that for a year. But you know, I think that's the one clearly they know a lot more about him than others do. Right. You know, Daryl Tapp coached him. Adam Peters was in San Francisco with him. Dan Quinn built his career off of, you know, coaching, starting with the defensive line. So those guys know, and they have a plan for him. I think I'm most curious to see what is that plan, and can you unlock more of the consistency from this game than maybe the Jets or Niners were able to do? And I know they feel like injuries played a big part in his not, and maybe in some of that inconsistency. So we'll see. And I would say like most curious about, because, you know, I don't know more than they do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm just getting your vibe.
Yeah, but I do think that's the one where you say, okay, let's see what they're doing there. But by and large, like I liked like the Jonathan Jones signing. I love that because I think he's their kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he gives you some of that flexibility with, and this just goes back to the article I just wrote, like, you don't have to get a corner in the first round or second round if it's not there. If you want it, if you say like, we like this guy better, but we want to get a corner later in the draft to develop, you can do that because you have Jones and Sammer still with Marshawn Lattimore and Igben Ogbonnie back as well. So he has the flexibility to go inside or outside just like Sammer still. So I like that sign. Dietrich Wise, I like that. I think those are, again, their kind of guys. And you know, he's not a Pro Bowler, but I think he adds depth. I think the D-line depth is better than it was a year ago, 1 through 9, right? And do they need more? Yeah, you could use a young pass rusher. But I like the depth that they built. And I think that's important. And so, you know, I don't have any big issues with really anything they did, because they're, one thing too is a lot of these 1 year deals. So, you know, they're not locked into bad deals.
We're joined by John Keim, who covers the Commanders for ESPN.com on the Rude Guest Hotline. So you've reported, John, that the Commanders have met with Ohio State running back Travion Henderson multiple times. Is this a, we're going to pick him at 29 if he's there, or is this a, we're going to move back into the mid 30s, maybe 40 range, get some extra picks because we feel like we can nab him at that spot? What do you see as the most likely scenario for the Commanders?
Yeah, and to be clear, they've met with multiple running backs multiple times. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, you know what I mean? Like, so yeah, Travion's one of them, but they've met with others a few times as well. So I don't want to overstate one guy at this point. I do think that he would be very good in this offense. I don't know that I see them taking a running back in the first round. And so I think like he's a guy, like if he's sitting there at 61, how do you not consider him? Mm-hmm. I don't know that he will be there at 61. If you trade back and get, and if you're able to either pick up an extra pick or improve your draft standing, then, you know, by with some picks in the third round or whatever, like, then I think, yeah, I think he would have to be under consideration. I don't know if at 29, I can't say that at 29 he would be, but again, like, he's not the only back that they've met with a couple times. So I don't want to overstate that interest. I, you know, but clearly there is, because he would fit very well with what they want to do. But, you know, there are also good backs that they've looked at who will be available in the fourth, third or fourth round as well. So I think that's, you know, that's clearly a possibility as well. Because I'm not convinced that they would take a running back at 29. Mm-hmm. I don't. And then it depends, like, well, how is the board falling? What's there?
Right.
You know, is there a scenario of, there's probably a scenario for most things, but, you know, depending on who is or isn't there, I could see, like, if you trade back, is he a possibility? I would have to say, sure, because I don't know that he's not, you know.
How many receivers have they met with multiple times, and would you be surprised if they took a receiver at 29?
A little bit. It depends on who's there, because I don't – this is not a draft where teams are expecting a lot of receivers to go in the first round.
Right.
So I think that's – you know, but if a Mecca Ibuka is there, mm-hmm. is he a possibility? Sure. But again, I think then it's like, who else is there? I think, to be honest, if there's an offensive lineman there they like, I think that guy is, I think, you know, I could see them running to the podium for that. You know, I think if there's an edge rusher they really like, you know, then that's another possibility. Corners is certainly a possibility, but I think if you want to continue going back to the first thing we talked about, the article about Jaden, one of the things that they talk about is adding talent, and receiving talent would certainly help. I do think there's some guys after the first round, though, that they like, and you know, and this is like based on number of meetings or whatever. So, and some of this stuff, like, you hear, listen, there are a lot of players in this draft that they're going to like that they can't take.
Sure.
So, you know what I mean? It's just like, just, yeah. But I, guys like Jaden Higgins, Jalen Noel, like those guys, Ty Felton, who's, all those guys will be after the first round. So I don't know, you know, if you're going to feel compelled to take one at 29, but it, you know, again, I mean, I know I'm an Ohio State guy, but Emeka Ogbuka should be a very good NFL receiver for any team. And so you'd have to look at him. But again, then it just depends on who else, what else is available when you're picking.
Most of the mock drafts, I know mock drafts mean nothing, okay? It's just opinions by these guys. But most of the mocks, I would say 65, 70% have them going edge if they stay at 29.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of edge. I've seen some offensive tackles as well. But I would agree with you. I don't think they're going to take a running back unless maybe a Hampton slipped and they really love Hampton out of North Carolina. But I
right.
still don't see them taking a running back in the first round. If they stayed at 29, I could see them going edge or possibly receiver. But, I would be very surprised if they took a running back.
And I think certainly, you know, clearly they would like a young pass rusher. There's two things that Dan Quinn will always talk about defenses. One is affecting the passer, and two is taking the ball away.
Mm-hmm.
So who are guys who can do that? What, you know, is there, you know, a cornerback who can do that? Is a safety? I don't know. I'm not sure I don't know, you know, Emin Wari and Starks, I don't know if they'd be available there. The two top safeties in this class probably. So I think edge, but I definitely, I put O-line on there. Definitely would put O-line on there because, again, go back, and it's funny because I looked up my article just to remind myself, and the pressure percentage and the sack percentage went up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think a lot of it is that's what they want to resolve. So, you know, there was definitely some pressure in that interior. Like, if they can improve that, I think they absolutely would. And so I think I would put that definitely on the list of desires that they want to fill. But edge would be their corner for sure. And again, running back is such a deep class. That, and you know, it's funny because it depends who you talk to, but like Gentry, people would put him in the obviously number one, right? Beyond that, like when I've talked to some people who feel like there's not a wide variance in this running back class in terms of like talent and ability. So like 1 through 9 or 10 or 2, I'd say maybe 10, put Gentry aside, but 2, maybe the next 8 or 9, there are some people who don't think like there's this big wide variance. So if you got one in the third round or fourth round, the value is there, right? So I think that's something that you have to look at. Now, they may not be the same type, but they can certainly come in and help you. That's why I think you could fall there. But like running, you know, again, yeah, edge help. I think one thing, I go back to the article I wrote the other day, which is that I don't know that they're going to force that pick. I think what they did is in free agency, put themselves in a position where they can get something that they really want versus something they really need.
Right.
So if there's not an edge guy, like there are a couple of edge guys, like, you know, they all have questions on them. Mm-hmm. So do you have to take one at 29? There are some guys, like there's an Olafadu kid from UCLA who will not go in the first round, most likely, but is he there at 61? Possibly. That's a great spot for him. And, you know, so you know what I mean? You get a guy, a young guy, you can develop, and they don't have to come in and be a three down guy. So you don't have to force that pick at 29. I think that's the best thing they did in free agency.
All right, John, good stuff. Looking forward to the draft on Thursday. It's John
Kime. Talk to you next week.
From ESPN.com. Awesome. Thanks, guys. Pal.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, I think that they are in a position where they could draft anything. I went on commanders.com while we're talking to them, the official website of the team, and they call it Mock Draft Monday, and they have a different mock draft. And in the first round, the Commanders site points to Yahoo's mock draft where the Commanders take Omario Hampton with the first pick, running back North Carolina.
Yeah, Omarion Hampton. Yeah, if he drops to 29, I think that would be one of the easiest cards to turn in ever, because, I mean, I've seen him going 20 to the Broncos. Like, they desperately need RB help. I don't think he'd be there at 29, but, I mean, weirder things have happened on draft day.
But I think the point is that they're not locked into a certain position.
Right.
We think that they'll go edge, but they could easily go with positions that could surprise you.
Correct.
800-636-1067 is the number you want to chime in throughout the show. Daniel Kelly, former New York Jets scout, is going to join us coming up at 9 o'clock as we talk more NFL draft. And remember, in the 8 o'clock hour, 9 o'clock hour, we're giving away tickets to Game 2 of the Caps playoff series against the Canadiens. And we're doing it all day on 106.7 The Fan. Listen every hour from 8:20 a.m. to 5:20 p.m. for your chance to win playoff tickets.
Welcome back. It is B. Mitch and Finley. Toby Altizer in for JP today. A reminder, we got Caps tickets all day long, giving away Game 2 tickets every hour at 20 minutes past the hour until 5:20. Your next chance to win coming up in about 15 minutes at 12:20. Right now, it's time to get out to the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV, and bring in Washington legend Fred Smoot. Smoot, what's going on, man?
What's going on, fellas? How y'all doing, man?
Can't complain.
We good, young man. How you doing?
I'm great. No JP again today. Hey, I'm used to it. It happens.
Hey, you're starting to learn that. So, Fred, as you look at this draft, okay, and I know that you really get into this, and people, y'all listen to Fred. He might talk crazy about a lot of stuff, but he truly gets involved with the draft. What position you think the Commanders should be looking at 29?
At 29, and, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about this draft, especially compared to last year's draft, say it's not as talented. I think it is talented. It's more starters than it is a Pro Bowlers, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a blue-collar draft, like a lot of dudes in the draft. And at 29, B. Mitch, truly, I'm going to move back if it's me personally. I'm going to move back. I'm going to try to get more draft capital. I'm going to try to add more young talent to offset some of the older talent I added on the team. At 29, like everybody tell you, when it comes to this draft, from pick 25 to pick 75, these players, to me, grades are not too different in certain positions. You want to talk about the running back position? I think legitimately it's 25 guys that's going to get drafted at the running back position. You want to talk about the interior rush? It's a lot of good D tackles in this draft. You want to talk about like edge rushes? I know it's some guys at the top, but it's some guys in the middle too that I think they can get it done. So I think it's deeper than most people say it is. I think they say it's not deep because it's only a few quarterbacks. And I was listening to I was listening to the Junkies earlier, and I think they had a former GM in from the New York Jets, if I remember. And And I respect everybody. Like, this all we doing is offering up our expertise. But he said something like Shedeur was undraftable, like on his draft board.
Insane.
And I would like to go against it. I would say he reminds me of a guy that I played with coming out in 2001, and that was Drew Brees. Like, Drew Brees did not have the biggest arm. Drew Brees was not the biggest person. He threw with anticipation. He knew pocket presence. He knew how to manipulate a pocket. Everybody's not going to look good on paper. That don't mean they can't play his game.
Yeah, where do you land on these quarterbacks? Because I like Shedeur Sanders. I think that he can be a really solid quarterback. I understand Cam Ward's probably going number one overall because maybe the ceiling's a bit higher. But how do you rank those guys? And then after that, Jackson Dart and Jalen Milroe, Tyler Shuck, how do you have the quarterbacks ranked?
Of course, Cam, he's number one, but it's something about that buyers beware with that number one pick at quarterback. I don't think in the last 10 years a quarterback that was drafted number one has even been to the playoffs, let alone, like, contended. So, buyers beware with the number one pick. But I think the one thing he does a great job of is playing off schedule and manipulating the pocket making it what he wants it to be. Not really weaponizing his legs all the time to do it. It's just a good awareness in the pocket. And I just told you how I felt about Shedeur. I give him more props than they gave him, and it's more than just the fact that his last name is Sanders. I love for my quarterbacks to not go to the powerhouse schools. Like, I would rather for my quarterback to have to problem solve on his way to the top instead of having a first-round wide receiver, a first-round tight end, and a first-round offensive line right in front of him. I don't know who you really are then. And Jackson Dart, I think Jackson Dart is going to be the most intriguing one of these guys because he doesn't do anything great, but he does a little bit of everything good. He runs better, and he's a better athlete than you think he is. He throws the ball and puts it down the field. But I think when they talk about him, it's going to be, can he be the same player week in and week out? One Jackson Dart you meet Monday, the next Sunday it could be a whole nother Jackson Dart. But when it comes to these quarterbacks, they're going to always be compared to their counterparts from last year, and there's no comparison.
I wonder if the fact that Shedeur's last name is Sanders is causing a lot of these people pause, because let's be real. You were in the league for a long time. I was too. And when you felt strong enough and you would challenge people, they never liked that. And Deion is going to challenge him, and I'm sure his son has some of that Deion in him. Can that be why this guy said, he's undraftable, because he don't know how to deal with him?
If they don't know what to say, because he's a Sanders that's not fast. Right, so they're saying you ain't got one of your daddy's number one traits, but I can tell you what he is. He's a problem solver. I can tell you what. And guess what? Here go the blessing about it all, Mitch. I know people don't say you backwards for saying that. Sometimes it don't pay for you to go in the top 15. What if he goes in the bottom 20 of the first round? Don't you know that's a better team? Like, Pittsburgh is a better situation than Cleveland. Like, Pittsburgh is a better situation than New Orleans. Sometimes falling in the draft worked for a guy by the name of Drew Brees that ended up going to San Diego. So it's just sometimes let things happen that they should happen. And maybe he just maybe benefits from not having to go to a team that needs to retool the whole team. But, yeah, because his last name is Sanders. And that's why I say he's just Drew Brees with a gold chain on, and sometimes people don't like that.
Talking with Fred Smoot here on the Rude Guest Hotline on B. Mitch and Finley. Toby Altizer in for JP today. I think a lot of people expect edge rusher at 29. I've seen some people maybe talking to Trevion Henderson at 29. Do you think there's any chance they could go corner? Is there something that you feel like they could upgrade there? Or maybe it's someone in the second round. Is there a corner that you like there?
Toby, from what we did in the offseason through the free agent moves, we are a team that's set up for best player available. We're going to let the draft dictate where we go. We're not going to dictate the draft. And I would tell the fans this, too. We always looking for the new hot item. Don't forget about the items we bought last year. Jean Baptiste is going to get better. Right, Tyler Owens is going to get better. Marshawn Lattimore will be better. Like, sometimes you have the answer on your roster, but people don't want to give players time to mature, right? And to mature and get better, they will. So let's not forget about the guys that we already have on the roster, but I think we are going to let it fall to us. That's what happened in Philadelphia. They weren't supposed to get Jaden Collins. He fell to them. Right? Like, sometimes you sit there, you put yourself, when you get Laremy Tunsil, that allows you to move Coleman down. That strengthens your offensive line. You resign some veterans on this team, Bobby Wagner and a lot of more guys. So you're not really filling gaps. I'm looking for situational football players right now. I'm looking for a situational pass rusher, somebody that don't even have to take on a run on first and second down. I'm looking for a situational running back. Like, so I think we just set ourselves up to just let everything fall to us.
You know, I look at the draft every year, and we get a lot of rumors about certain people, and they may fall in the draft. Some of them don't fall. Hell, Laremy Tunsil fell in the draft some years ago, but still, he look where he's at. But multiple years later, still a five-time Pro Bowler, All-Pro, has done great stuff out there. James Pierce Jr. keeps getting the rap of having issues. And the only issue I found was that he was speeding and he didn't have his insurance with him. Now, there are some other guys out there who got sexual assaults and every damn thing else. They're not being discussed as issues. Could this whole thing on James Pierce Jr. be somebody starting a rumor to try to get him to fall?
Well, you know how I go around this time. You got 50% rumors, 50% truth. And for some GMs, it doesn't matter. And some guys, it does. And you know how that is, B-Mitch.
Hell,
like,
yeah.
It's like a little bit of everything. The mud getting slung around. And he's been a guy that they've been tagged him as this month since the draft process started. But if a guy like that talented fall at you, and you know your franchise is set up to nurture somebody like that, your franchise is set up to lock room is set up, which our locker room is set up for that. Now we can take these chances. 3 years ago, we couldn't take those chances. Now we can't do that on a high-end rushing end that all he needs is some tender love and care. Like, listen, for all the Dow Greens on your team, you better have you some Dexter Manless. I know that. B-Bitch, you know for a fact has to be a mixture. It can be a mixture of choir boys, but we need a couple edgy guys. We don't know if they're going to show up, but if they do, we know what we're going to get.
100%, baby.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on that. Appreciate it. Talking to Fred Smoot here on the Rootcast Hotline. You talked about the running back class being deep. Who's someone that's not being talked about enough that you would like maybe in the later rounds or something that Washington could target?
I like that. I like Tutone from Virginia Tech. The question is, can he put on a couple pounds and still keep the speed? Everybody's in love with Trevion Henderson, rightly so. He got a little B-Mitch in him. He can do a little bit of everything. He's very versatile. He's from the area. He's from Virginia. I like Rocket Sanders. Nobody's talking about Raheem Sanders from South Carolina. You want to talk about somebody that's big, that can flat out run downhill, that can break the long ball, that'll probably be there available maybe in the fourth, fifth, and sixth round. Unbelievable talent right there. You got Johnson from Iowa. I think the one thing he got more wiggle than people think he has. And that's why this is a draft. I'm not going to be forced to take a running back in the first round. It's just too many of those guys. And it's whatever flavor do you want. Do you want the big guy to come downhill? Or do you want the guy that can break the big play? If it's me personally, I'm trying to add explosiveness to this offense. That's all I want to add. I just want to add speed. So if I'm adding speed through the running back position, through the tight end position, I mean, a wide receiver position. I don't care. I want some people that can get the ball in their hand and make plays. And maybe Tutone is that guy. Maybe it's Rocket Sanders. I don't know. But it's just a lot of guys to choose from.
The comment you just made about this locker room being equipped now to be able to deal with some people that may need just a little diligence. I was telling Toby that before we started this show today, because I think every time you look at anybody to have a problem, back in the day, we always said, oh, well, if we got somebody with a problem, don't bring them here, because they were going to just their problems will be enhanced. Now, they have everything in place, from front office to coaching staff to inside the locker room to help those guys out. And I'd be damned if I'm going to walk past a guy that has extreme talent because of some minor thing out there.
Well, you know how I get. Like my grandma used to say about my uncle all the time. She was like, I don't have to spend this time with your mama like I got to spend. I got the love on your uncle, all right, because he's a problem. I got the love on him. And that's what, like, that's what happens. And guess what? When somebody feel the love, they feel appreciated, they feel protected, you can get the best out of them. Oh, they're not coming in here with their head held down because you heard about what happened in my past. No, we worried about your future. And that's what we going to do as a whole group. We're going to do that as a coaching staff. We're going to do that as a community. We're going to love on you. So sometimes, like you say, we are built for that now. Would I have said did this a couple of years ago? No, nope. I would have said no, just leave it alone.
Hell yeah.
What do you think about Travis Hunter? You think he can play both ways in the NFL? Which side do you think he's better at?
I think he might be legitimately a better wide receiver right now. When I watch him play wide receiver, I see a little hybrid between Justin Jefferson and Devontae Smith. Now, he's very wiggly. He high points the ball. His ball skills are off the chain. I think he's just an inch. So if I'm saying he a top 10 wide receiver, pick at wide receiver, he's still a bottom of the first round cornerback. So he's still up there. Like, he's still up there. He has a little champion when it comes to when he plays defense. But if I had him on his team, he's so unique. I'd be doing my team a disjustice if I literally brought him on the team and then play him as both, some kind of way. Do I think he can learn corner faster than he can learn wide receiver because the offensive playbook is just that challenging? It is, but I would not challenge him to learn the whole playbook. I would challenge him to learn the Hunter package. I would have a legit red zone package for him, and I have some third down and some big plays for him. So it's all about the team that get him. But if he ain't got a quarterback throwing to him on offense, he will look mediocre, and if he doesn't have a pass rush on defense, he has a chance to look mediocre. The big question is going to be for him, how would he last four quarters when the offense is going to plan to run at you to tire you out? Are you going to be able to take on the run, take on the pass, and then go run routes against number one corners in the league? I don't know. It could take a toll, but he does have the skill set to do it. I'm eager to see it. He might be football Shohei. I want to see it.
Well, you know what, Fred? I don't think it's happening. I don't think this league is going to. They are not going to. He may play sparingly at one position than the other, but he's not going to be playing. Like he wants to play both ways all the time. Not at this level.
No, it won't be, like I said, a package on offense.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you utilize him that much on offense until you need big plays. I'd say maybe 15 plays at the most, 12 plays a game on offense, the rest on defense. He doesn't play in the return game, so that's where he can get him some rest. But like I say, D-Mitch, it's going to be, how do he take on the NFL run game? How do he tackle these running backs? How do he tackle these 6'5", 240-pound tight ends? And how many times does he get back up?
Yeah,
that's going to be the thing.
Exactly.
I want to ask you about one more guy. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Washington because I don't think he'll get there at 29, but one of my favorite players in this draft, Smoot, is Jahdae Barron out of Texas. What do you make of him as a DB that can do a little bit of everything?
Me and Logan has been going back and forth about Barron. His film is unbelievable, right, Toby? His film is unbelievable. The big games, he makes plays. He doesn't run well to us. The one thing about him, and I think he has to be a nickelback. Everybody looks at him and say he can play outside. I think in this league, he's going to capitalize from being a nickelback. I am eager to see how he does down the field with the taller receivers, the Mike Evans of the world. How does he does with Marvin Harrison Jr.? I want to see that, but his film is so good, you cannot deny that he's a talent. But can I get that talent, same talent, In the second or third round? Could I go to Kansas State? Could I, like, he's intriguing. He's intriguing to me, but I just don't know what type of pro he's going to be.
That's NFL draft expert Fred Smoot.
I told you, when he's talking about cooking, I don't believe nothing he said. When he's talking about draft, I believe everything he said.
Hey, what got you into being so deep into the draft here? This is awesome.
Man, I was always into the draft before I even got drafted, man. I just love the draft process. I call it the trail of tears. Somebody going to be very happy that weekend, and some people going to be very mad that weekend, but you will get the emotions out of people. It's the weekend that the people change. They life change. So I was always one. I like to study a guy because I want to try to figure out what's that one trait that you need from a guy to guarantee that he's going to be a good pro, and nobody has figured that out. Sometimes it's a trial and everything. And I also think it's just the love for the game. If a guy loves the game, he'll figure out a way to make a team, and he'll figure out a way to get better.
All right, if Jeff was coming out of college, what would his draft report be?
Jeff? No, see, we'll be Jeff getting Jeff in that equipment room. You know, we need Jeff to hand out that equipment. We're going to tell him that your career is over with. Now, you got a couple of options. You can be a coach assistant. We can let you in the medical room. But, you know, we're not going to play these athletic games with Jeff. I've heard the stories with Jeff in the helmet that never was. I've heard the story. I literally watched. I cringe when this happened, B. Mitch, when he let the whole community down. When he lost that freestyle battle, it's over and over with Jeff, man.
Smoot, it's always good to chat, man. Appreciate you hopping on.
All right, thanks, fellas.
Take care, man.
That's Fred Smoot. He joined us on the Rude Guest Hotline. Always a great guest here on B-Mitch and Finley. Right now, be caller number 9 to 800-636-1067 and win a pair of tickets to Game 2 for the 2025 playoffs with the Washington Capitals. On Wednesday, April 23rd, against Montreal at Capital One Arena. For tickets and more information, visit thefandc.com. Coming up next, we'll take a look at trading down potentially for the Washington Commanders in the NFL draft.
Voice of the Nats here on The Fan with Charlie Slows is our guy, Dave Jagler. Jags, 7-0 win, out hitting Baltimore 14-1 last night. A lot to like. I want to start with Dylan Cruz. 3 home runs in 4 games. His expected batting average is now up over .280. I'd say he's right where he needs to be at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing is, Grant, is he had no panic when his batting average started with a 0, and even when it started with a 1, I mean, you could still see the process was good. And, you know, he had some tough luck. I mean, he had that one stretch in the first week of the season where he struck out 8 at-bats in a row, but that's a thing of the past. And he'd been hitting some hard contact. And, you know, in Colorado, Mickey Moniak made a diving catch and took away a 2-run triple. You felt that he hit some balls hard right at people. And when he hit the 2 home runs to right center field in consecutive at-bats, you're like, okay, I think he's about to take off here. And yesterday hit a home run to the pole side. So everything seems to be going well for him. And you know, even when he was struggling, he was still giving you good defense. And when he was on base, he was a factor. His legs helped steal a run in the Rockies series. So a pretty good sign of maturity to be able to shake off a rough start, because if you have this kind of stretch, you know, 40, 50 at-bats in the middle of the season, not as big a deal. But when it's the first 50 at-bats of the season and you're hitting 100, it's on the scoreboard for everyone to see and their questions being asked. But he stayed within himself, and I think you're starting to see him come out of it very well.
Jax, Mitchell Parker last night, 8 innings, 1 hit. If I'd have known that little measly opposite field single from Cedric Mullins was going to be it, goodness gracious, 17 in a row to end the game. He's not striking out a ton of guys. So kind of how's he doing it at this point, mixing those pitches, huh?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, there's more than one way to get guys out. I mean, obviously the strikeout is the sexy way to do it. But, you know, if you can get outs with weak contact, and he's not a ground ball pitcher. He's going to pitch up in the zone. So that's a thin margin for error. If you're not quite up in the zone enough, then those balls are going to be hit for extra base hits. But when he's right, you know, something about his delivery and just a little bit of finish on the fastball makes it play a little higher than the 93 or 94 you might pop on a radar gun. But you saw a whole lot of just weak contact and pop-ups against Parker. And so it's a different style of pitching. I mean, you know, guys who have some deception and some life up in the zone can be successful. The key is to stay there. And if you're going to miss up and out of the zone rather than miss down in the center of the hitting zone. And that's when he'll get in trouble. But so far, you know, his misses when he was out of the zone were up and out of the zone. All right, a couple of walks, pitch around those. The other thing that he's doing very well, Danny, in all of his starts this year, is he's not panicked with men on base. He's made and seemed to be at his best when there are runners on base, and he's limited damage.
Jags, I've thoroughly enjoyed the top 2 spots in the order pretty often here when it's been James Wood and Nathaniel Lowe of late. Wood, who had 3 hits, 2 extra base hits last night, and then Nathaniel Lowe with the 2-run homer in the first, who's got the team lead, 19 runs batted in. Those are the 2 guys with OPSs up over .870. Is that something that might stick here?
I think it's going to change when C.J. Abrams comes back. I mean, C.J. played his second game earlier today for Harrisburg, so I've got to think by this weekend against the Mets, or maybe even as soon as tomorrow, who knows, we'll see C.J. in the lineup. So I would assume that C.J. would go back to the top spot for the most part, but then maybe it's Wood 2 and Lowe 3, although against certain pitchers you're not going to stack the three lefties in a row. But yeah, I mean, it's a good deal to have your top two, you know, OPS guys or run producers at the top. And, you know, to me, there's so much on James Wood at a young age. You know, Wood didn't have a great doubleheader on Sunday, and the team struggled to score. You know, he had a three-hit game with four RBIs. Saturday, they score 12. Last night, he has two extra base hits and three hits. They score seven. When James Wood goes, this offense goes. So there's a lot on his shoulders, and he continues to produce, and we love to see it.
Jags, awesome as always, man. Have a great call tonight.
It could happen.
See you, my friend.
And was one of the original guys at Pro Football Focus. He left about a year ago to go to the 33rd team. I've always enjoyed Sam's football analysis, and I had him on my podcast over the weekend, and I wanted to play a lot of it back. Now, I started by asking him about the possibility that Trey Hendrickson gets dealt before the draft or maybe on draft day. Here's what he said.
I don't, because I think the Bengals still desperately need him. You know, they tried to sort of future-proof that position a couple of years ago with drafting Miles Murphy in the first round. That hasn't worked out. And if they didn't have Trey Hendrickson on last year's defense, you know, it would be one of the worst defenses the game has ever seen, even with him playing at an all-pro kind of level. It was a terrible defense. So I think they need to keep him around. I think there's a deal to be done that makes everybody happy, even with the contracts they've already handed out. So my gut reaction is they still figure out a way of making it work.
All right, let's talk draft. Travis Hunter is the best player in an NFL draft since who?
I think it's hard to quantify how good he is, because what makes him special is unique. He wouldn't be the best wide receiver in last year's draft. He wouldn't be the best cornerback in a lot of drafts. But the fact that he's in the conversation for both at the same time is, I mean, it's not quite unprecedented, but you have to go back to like the 60s when players were two-way players regularly. You know, since the NFL went to multiple sides of the ball, everybody playing one side, we really haven't seen a player like Travis Hunter come along. Guys have come along who have dabbled with both, you know, played a little bit on one side of the ball while playing predominantly on the other. You know, Champ Bailey or Charles Woodson or Chris Gamble, like, that's happened before. But we haven't seen a guy that's been an every down starter on both sides of the ball and arguably a top five player in the nation at both of them at the same time. It's completely ridiculous. It's basically unprecedented in the modern era, and that's what makes him great. And a big part of that question is, how sustainable is that in the NFL? I mean, it shouldn't have been sustainable in college, so he's already breaking new ground. But we don't know yet what this is going to look like in the NFL. You know, all those other guys that dabbled with it in college were fairly well shut down in the NFL and just turned into, you know, one side of the ball players. You know, maybe they would get a couple of snaps here or there on the other side of the ball, but effectively they became just a specialist on one side of the ball. It sounds like the NFL is going to give Travis Hunter a legitimate shot to play both ways in some capacity. And that unknown, the level of the some capacity, I think is what determines how great he can be. If he's able to do something approaching what he was doing in college in the NFL, it would make him one of the greatest players in the game. If he becomes, you know, a player that basically plays almost all of the snaps on one side of the ball and then a handful of plays on the other side, it's still valuable. It's still incredibly impressive, but I think it's a lot less, you know, generational and sort of awe-inspiring than the potential of what he could do if he was allowed to do what he did in college.
Well, what should he focus on at the NFL level? Which side of the ball?
It's tough because, look, it depends what the goal is, right? If he wants to maximize his potential, I think wide receiver earns more money than cornerback. That's just a reality. I think he's a better wide receiver than he is a cornerback, so everything would be pushing you towards playing receiver first and figuring out corner second. But, you know, there are teams that have the greater need at corner. And I think it's easier to, if you're going to play him two ways to some degree, it's a much easier balancing act to have him as a full-time corner and then put him in there for some snaps on offense than it is the other way around, where, you know, teams very, very rarely have a defensive back on a sort of pure pitch count. You know, there you have sub-package corners, nickelbacks, dime corners, those types of things. But the problem with that is if you're kind of at the mercy of what the offense does then. If you just had Travis Hunter is your nickel corner. I mean, you can be trapped in nickel for the entire game if a team wants to do that by just putting out, you know, the correct personnel on offense to put you in that situation. So you're not necessarily in control of the snaps he's playing as easily in terms of if he's playing defense. So if it was me, I would have him as a full-time wide receiver and then try and figure out what the best way of using him on defense is. But I think that's where he's at his best.
Who's the best quarterback in this draft, and where would he have been taken in last year's draft?
I think it's Cam Ward, definitely. I think he's got the easiest tool set to sell yourself on. He's got all the physical ability. He's got some incredible throws on his tape. You know, he's a little bit of a big game hunter, a bit of a maverick, a bit of a gunslinger, all those cliches, and that can be a little bit scary. But I think he would be up in the conversation with the sort of second tier of the top six last year. I mean, so many quarterbacks went, and they all went early. But even with that group, it felt like there was a fairly strong consensus that it was the top three, Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, and Drake May. And then the next three, J.J. McCarthy, Bo Nix, and Michael Penix Jr. sort of came out of nowhere to be in that group as well. I think he belongs in that second group somewhere. And obviously those guys ended up getting squeezed much tighter together than people thought they would. But I think he would be in that collection of quarterbacks a year ago.
Where does Shedeur Sanders go?
That's the big X factor in this draft. You know, you can make a case that he should still go two or three to one of the two really quarterback-needy teams in Cleveland and the Giants, even with the sort of veteran additions that they've made. But if he doesn't, and if teams do think that, you know, there's not enough sort of physical special tools there and he starts sliding, there aren't that many teams that it makes sense to halt that slide for a while. You know, the Saints, obviously, at nine are the obvious ones. The Steelers that we talked about, if Rodgers doesn't sign with them, might be forced into doing it. And if either one of those teams thinks a different quarterback is QB2 in this draft, I mean, Sanders could seriously slide.
On the running back conversation, how many go in the first round? And what's your philosophy now on running backs in the first round?
My hunch is probably two. I could just about see three, but I can't see any more than that. I think something like the answer is probably somewhere between one and two. I think ultimately, if you think the guy is special, I have no problem with drafting a running back in the first round. If you don't think he's special, particularly in this year, I think it makes all the sense in the world to wait, because there's a lot of talented running backs that are going to be available on day two and even day three. The question to me is not so much would you take them in the first round. It's number one, what is the opportunity cost? What are you leaving on the table to take the running back? And number two, how high can you draft him? And I think that's where, you know, I don't have a problem with taking a guy in the first round, but I think there is a level at which it doesn't make sense to take them. You know, a level up in the draft, a number at which point it doesn't make any sense to draft the guy, because immediately the contract in the top five is making him one of the best paid running backs in the NFL. And so much of the value of those guys is, you know, the surplus value based off how cheap the rookie contracts are.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. It's like, you know, Washington, I think, will take a running back in this draft, Sam. But unless they believe that Hampton or Travion Henderson is Saquon Barkley or Christian McCaffrey or Jahmyr Gibbs or Bijan Robinson, I think they should wait. I don't think that player should be selected in the first round. Like, you got to really feel like the impact is going to be Barkley-esque to take a running back in the first round.
Yeah, and the difference is, with some other positions, like running back, you can find great running backs all the way through the draft. I mean, look at Bucky Irving last year for the Buccaneers. You can't say that for a lot of other positions. It's not that there are none of them. You know, almost every position is spitting out some form of impressive NFL player at every round in the draft. But at certain positions, so like a huge proportion of the impact players come right at the sharp end of the draft. So when you're looking at these players and you're like, well, we've got a couple of needs, one of them's running back, you know, but the other position, you're much less likely to be able to come back in the third round and find a player that can come in and make an impact the way you can with running back. So I think that's the problem. And that's why you need to be convinced that the guy is special and a gap, you know, a significant gap between him and the other running backs in this draft. And I think you can definitely make that argument for Ashton Jeanty, who I think will probably go in the top 10 pick somewhere, I don't think you can really make the case for anybody else in this draft. Omarion Hampton from North Carolina is really good, but I'm not 100% convinced he's better than a couple of other running backs in this draft. So, you know, I don't think you make that decision. But if Jeanty's on the board, I think that's different because, you know, he looks like far and away the best running back in this draft.
Well, it sounds like we're on the same page as it relates to Hampton. I'm just curious, who are the other backs in the draft that you don't see much difference between Hampton and those guys? Who are those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hampton is the second best back in this class. I had him in at second in my rankings. But, you know, if you run an outside zone scheme, I think you could easily talk yourself into Caleb Johnson from Iowa being just as good as Omarion Hampton, if not better. Travion Henderson from Ohio State is a better pass protector, is potentially more explosive, and was a pretty good running back in his own right when he had the sort of bell cow workload at Ohio State before they brought in Quinshon Judkins. Judkins himself is a very similar sort of athletic prototype or profile to Omarion Hampton, and you could talk yourself into him making that kind of impact as well. So I think there's a group of other running backs once you get beyond Jeanty that are very similarly lumped together. And, you know, if you're making that decision, do we take Hampton or do we wait around or two when one of these guys is going to be available, you know, you might end up getting the better player having waited.
The guy that I like, and I'm just curious as to what you think, but I've loved Damian Martinez since his Oregon State days. Would you put him into that group? Because if you could get him on day three, to me, that's better than taking Hampton in the first round. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely agree. I really like Damian Martinez. Incredibly young as well, and has done it in multiple different schemes. And then Dylan Sampson from Tennessee as well, I think, is in that group. Very different body type and a different sort of running back style, much smaller, so he doesn't have the sort of giant physical NFL body type that you would love, but I think talent-wise is in that category as well. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think that's the reason why, you know, if Jeanty's off the table and I'm debating a running back, that's the reason why I'm waiting in the first round.
All right. The odds are, at least, you know, from the books, Washington will end up taking, you know, a defensive end slash edge in the first round. So if I tell you that it is an edge at 29, they don't move back, they don't move up, tell me who you think is there and who the right fit for Washington would be at 29 as an edge player.
I think projecting the edge class this year is really difficult.
Right.
Everyone agrees that Abdul Carter is edge one. And after that, it gets chaotic because every one of the next sort of five or six guys has got some kind of flaw or red flag or just something to be scared of. And whether it's sample size, whether it's, you know, off field, whether it's attitude, whether it's lack of production, every one of these guys got some reason that you wouldn't want to draft them or that you would be at least hesitant to pull that trigger. But it's a different thing for almost each guy, and I think that introduces an amazing amount of randomness because we've no idea what each team is going to think about each one of those red flags. So I think that group could go in almost any order, and it could go in almost any sort of level of the first round depending on how much or little teams care about those red flags. I think the guys with the best chances of being there by the time Washington pick, it wouldn't shock me if Michael Williams from Georgia slipped a little bit, just a sort of general, wasn't quite the athlete that people were expecting him to be, you know, is a little bit on that lack of production end of the spectrum as well. The selling point for those sort of lack of production guys is, yeah, but he's a special athlete and, you know, we'll put it together at the NFL level. But Williams actually isn't quite the level of special athlete. So suddenly I think that's just a harder sell for NFL teams. Donovan Azuraku, I could see being around there, and I think he's sort of underrated relative to these other guys. I would love that as a pick for Washington. He's got elite pass rushing sort of chops, pass rushing tool set. I think he can play against the run as well. I think that part of his game is a little bit underrated. So I think he could be there. And then depending on, I think James Pierce is a big X factor. He's got mid to high first round tape, but there's a lot of the sort of the swirl about him is it's off field in the kind of work ethic, attitude world. You know, it's not necessarily legal trouble. It's not, you know, drugs. It's none of that stuff. It's like, you know, why was Tennessee not playing him every down? You know, there's a lot of sort of talk about that he didn't necessarily commit to it full time in a way that's above and beyond. You know, sometimes you hear that from scouts whenever a guy has like a hobby, you know, or enjoys basketball or something ridiculous. It's like, well, does he really love football? That's crazy. But it's stronger than that with Pierce. And I wonder how much that's going to scare some teams away. It wouldn't shock me if Pierce fell out of the first round entirely. But equally, if he's there, I mean, his tape justifies that selection.
Yeah, I talked about this in the open. He's one that I would be very surprised if they took for those reasons. I mean, this is a team last year that 7 of their 9 picks were team captains as they were trying to change their culture. So, you know, I like Azarenko. I just wonder whether or not he's ready to be an edge-setting defensive end against the run versus more of just a specialized pass rusher to begin with. And they got gashed, Sam, last year against the run, especially, you know, sort of C-gap and outside. They really struggled to set the edge. And I'm curious as to whether or not you think there's one guy, you know, in that first, early, second round area that is head and shoulders above the others as a run stopper.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two guys that are sort of billed as the physical freak shows, Shamar Stewart and Michael Williams, I think those are the two best run-setting edge defenders in that kind of area. You know, Shamar Stewart in particular, we can all debate what he can become as a pass rusher and how concerning the lack of production is. The one thing I think that's pretty not even up for debate is that guy is a dominant run defender. He's incredibly powerful. He is able to just explode through offensive tackles, drive them into the backfield. If you drafted him high and had, you know, no real interest in his pass rush, and you said, look, you're going to go out there, you're going to absolutely murder the run, and then when we get to a passing down, just bull rush through the tackle, I think you would have a productive player.
Cornerback, who would be there and who would be worth taking at 29?
Corner, I think you're going to be in a good area there, depending on what exact type of corner you're looking at. But I think that's where there's a group of guys that are going to be available at that kind of spot. And it's sort of which one teams are most enamored with, whether it's Trey Amos from Ole Miss, Azariah Thomas from Florida State, Maxwell Hairston from Kentucky, Siobhan Revell. You know, press man teams will love him as well. I think he's a potential possible first-round player. That whole group of corners, I think, are going to start coming off the board towards that end of the first round, into the top of the second round. I really like Amos. I think Azariah Thomas is a very good player as well. And then Hairston has got crazy potential because of all that speed and explosiveness he showed.
I noticed that you had Benjamin Morrison from Notre Dame ranked really high on something that you did recently. He's a team captain. He's one of those high character guys. Is 29 too early for him?
It kind of depends. He's a big X factor player because it's all going to come down to the medical history with him.
Right.
I think he's got first round tape. I think he's got first round character. He's the most technically sound cornerback, I think, in this entire draft. But he has multiple, not just hip injuries, but hip surgery in his history. And that, I mean, hip surgery for a cornerback is a pretty scary thing. So look, none of us are doctors, but that's what the evaluation is going to come down to. If your medical team signs off on him and says, look, these were two freak injuries, they're dealt with, he's recovered, he's good to go, and they're not going to recur, I think you could easily justify Benjamin Morrison being drafted at the bottom of the first round. I think he's got that ability. But if that's something you're scared of and you say, look, these are going to come back, or, you know, this is going to be a reason that he's not the player that he used to be. You know, his hips are going to be tighter. His fluidity of movement is not going to be what it was. You know, all these things. Then you're going to have to drop him. And you have to say, look, he's not the player that he was when we were evaluating this tape.
The two safeties that are projected potentially in the first round, Amanah Worry from South Carolina, Starks from Georgia.
If I told you they took his safety, which one should we be most happy about?
Honestly, I think both of them are extremely good players, very different players. Starks, I think, it works in more schemes than Emenwari does. He's the sort of pure free safety coverage specialist, makes incredible plays on the ball, you know, has an amazing fluidity of movement at the safety position that we sort of just touched on with Benjamin Morrison. But he's able to fly despite the time 40 times just when he's doing actual sort of functional movement things. You know, when you watched him do the drills at the combine, his tracking data, the miles per hour stuff, he was basically the fastest guy at every drill,
right,
regardless of what his straight line sprinting 40 track time is. Emenwari, I think, is a little bit more boom or bust. Obviously an incredible physical specimen, absolutely blew up the combine in terms of measurements and speed and explosiveness. His tape, I think, is a little bit more inconsistent. Doesn't always play to those physical gifts, but I think both guys have clear first-round ability and would fit into that defense.
Two more for Sam Monson. Wide receiver at 29, you know, they've got Terry McLaurin. They added Debo in the offseason. They brought back Noah Brown. They schemed everybody open last year in the Kingsbury offense with Jaden. If it's a wide receiver at 29 and they're looking for, you know, somebody to really compliment Terry long-term, who is it?
Yeah, that's tough. I think that wide receiver class is kind of chaotic as well. You get beyond the first couple, and then we get into what's your flavor, what type of receiver you're looking for. I think Jaden Higgins from Iowa State would bring something different to that receiving core from the guys you just mentioned. He's got size, he's got length, he's got the ability to win inside and outside. He can be a true X wide receiver. Somebody like Luther Burden brings utterly ridiculous run-after-the-catch ability. I mean, when the ball is in his hands, he reminds me of prime Odell Beckham Jr. back with the Giants. You know, just this incredible tackle-breaking, you know, yards-after-the-catch machine. But I think he can run some routes as well. I think he's being slept on a little bit because of the season he's coming off. You know, a guy like Jalen Knoll from the other Iowa State receiver, incredible sort of vertical deep speed from the slot and can operate horizontally as well. I think there's a lot of options for them that would make sense at that kind of spot.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up Luther Burden. He's been one of my favorite players all year long, one of my favorite players until, you know, they traded Jahan Dotson last year in part because he took plays off, you know, during the season leading up to it. He didn't play to the whistle. Quinn basically wants guys that'll dive on the floor for loose balls. And I love Luther Burden with the ball in his hands. I mean, I think he is, I mean, he's not Tariq Hill, but he is really dangerous that way. But I just wonder whether or not they're going to love the kid overall as, you know, kind of a grinder and a gym rat. That's kind of what this organization seems to be looking for.
Yeah, and that was kind of that has been a lot of what's swirling around Luther Burden.
Yeah.
You know, did he kind of not quit on his team, but did he take those plays off? Did he sort of grow frustrated and it manifests in a negative way last season when his production dropped off, when his quarterback was hurt, you know, all those types of things. That's a fine line, right? I mean, the Giants sat Malik Nabers down last year. We saw this on Hard Knocks, and they were like, look, how would you handle when the ball's not going your way, when things are not going well? And he's like, it would make me mad. And they thought that was a great thing, right? And then halfway through the season, it's like Malik Nabers is making noise
because
he's not getting the football. It's like, well, that can cut both ways, right? So, yeah, I think that's definitely the thing that teams are going to have to weigh when they are evaluating Luther Burden. But you put on 2023 Luther Burden tape, that guy's a top 10 player in the draft, right? So that's the type of talent we're talking about. And then it's like, well, how much do we ding the way he behaved when the situation went south?
Sam Monson, everybody, the 33rd team on X, on Twitter, at Sam Monson NFL. Always generous with your time. I really appreciate it. Hopefully we can do it again before the season starts. Thanks. Enjoy next week.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Yeah, Sam had a lot more to say. You can listen to that on my podcast from Friday's show. When we come back, the guy that has become one of my favorite players in the draft, and he would fill a need for Washington. That's next.
All right. Over the weekend, the Nats split their Easter doubleheader with the Colorado Rockies. James Wood went 0-for after being pulled in the seventh inning of Saturday's game for Alex Call. They have the day off today and will take on the O's tomorrow at Nats Park on 106.7 The Fan. In the NBA, Cooper Flagg has declared his for the NBA draft. The Wizards have a 14% chance at landing the top pick along with the Utah Jazz and Charlotte Hornets. The draft lottery is May 12th. College football, Nico Amaliava has announced he is officially transferring to UCLA. The deal is reportedly in the $1.5 million to $2 million range, where he was making $2.4 at Tennessee. The Eagles have re-signed Cam Jurgens to a four-year $68 million deal. The extension ties him to Philly through the 2029 season. And the Washington Capitals will take on Ivan Demidov and the Montreal Canadiens in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference first round. They're still a bit banged up, though. Alexei Protas is out with a cut from a skate on his foot. He has been skating in a non-contact jersey at the past few practices, and Spencer Carberry says he should play at some point during this series. Martin Fierravari is questionable after turning his ankle against the New York Islanders. Jacob Chychrun will play after being struck in the face by a puck on Friday's practice. And Logan Thompson was the first off the ice at practice this morning. Spencer Carberry declined to name the starter in net for tonight. And that's what's trending.
Time to head out to the Rude guest hotline. Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. We say good morning to Mike Rizzo, president and general manager of the Washington Nationals, presented by Main Street Bank. Cheer local, bank local, put their team in your office. Visit mstreetbank.com for more information. Mike, hello.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
We're not doing as well as Mitchell Parker was on the bump last night. I mean, what an awesome outing by him. Eight innings pitched, allows just one hit, two walks, fans, four Orioles batters. His ERA is at a sparkling 1.39. I mean, were you just blown away by what he was doing last night on the mound?
Yeah, he's been a very consistent pitcher for us the last year and a half since we brought him up. And He had everything working last night. He was pounding the strike zone and kept the batters off balance and kept the ball off the barrel of the bat. And that's the secret to his success.
What's his background? Did he play college ball? Did you guys draft him right out of high school?
San Jacinto, it looks like. Junior college.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, he's a New Mexico kid that we drafted out of junior college in San Jacinto in the fifth round, which was that year. Remember, that was the last round, in that draft because of COVID. Mm. We took him in the fifth round, and development did a great job of him. Sammy Nairn and those guys down in the minor leagues, because he was a guy that had a really good arm, but scattered his fastball and didn't pitch with much command or feel because he was pretty raw. Off the mound. So, those guys did a great job with him in the minor leagues, and to his credit, he just, worked really hard to harness his stuff and throw strikes, which is his key and to his success. And, he pounds the strikes on with four quality pitches and lets the defense work behind him. He doesn't go into too many deep counts, and he's been very efficient with his pitch counts, which allows him to get deeper into games.
Yeah, I was going to say, you rarely see guys go eight innings anymore. I mean, going eight innings, I mean, usually guys go six. So for a guy to throw less than 100 pitches, go eight, man, he was on point last night.
Yeah, he was really showing up the zone for sure.
And Mike, in your scouting career, how many of the 50 United States have you visited on scouting trips?
I would think all of them. I haven't made a map of it, but I would imagine, in 25 years as a scout, and then kind of doing it as an executive, I've probably been to every place they play baseball in the world. I've probably been to. My wife gets on me a little bit because Europe and those type of things, not so much, but Guatemala and Colombia, yes, many times. So
you've been to Alaska on a scouting trip?
Oh yes. That Alaska Summer League was back in the day was a very important place to scout college players in the summer. So we've done that. I've been to Australia several times, obviously Japan, Korea, Taiwan. All the Latin American countries, obviously, and except for Cuba. I've never been to Cuba.
So last night, you know, the Orioles starting pitching has been really bad so far this year. I mean, they've had some injuries, but their starting pitching is worse than the league. And you guys took advantage of it. Your top four hitters, I believe, had nine hits, including three up top with Woody and on bobblehead night. So I was texting his dad. His dad, they kept showing his dad on camera on Masson. But talk about James Wood. Talk about Garcia's really good. Ruiz was on point last night.
Dylan Cruz on a heater.
Dylan Cruz hitting a bomb. So you guys were swinging the bats really good last night.
Yeah, good plan of attack against Kramer, and we got balls in the zone and didn't chase many pitches, which is kind of has been our Achilles heel. When we're bad offensively, we chase out of the zone too much, and we got balls in the zone and barreled them up last night. It was a good plan of attack, and Lowe got us going. He got a hanging slider and deposited him in the outfield, and Wood has been great for us, obviously. Lowe's been contributing, consistently for us. Starting to get Cruz on track, and his last eight or so games has been what we think he should be. And he's been a slow starter. Every rung in the minor leagues, he starts slow and kind of figures out a league and does well. So I think that we're all very hopeful that this is just another part of his development, where start a little slow, start and get a feel for it. If pitchers made an adjustment to him, he's starting to make adjustments to them. And they did a few mechanical tweaks with his swing, got him a little bit more upright, and I think he feels a lot better in the box. And they're getting go defense from him in center and in right, and he's a great base runner, and he's just a good baseball player. So right. Excited to see him. Tana came up, and he's going to get an opportunity to play against some right-handed pitching, and took advantage of that and got a couple of hits to the opposite field, and we played good defense, and threw strikes, played good defense, and got some big hits and some tack-on runs, which is important against a good team to tack on, and we did that.
Mike, you mentioned Cruz's base running. Pretty impressive. He leads the Nats right now with six stolen bases, despite his on-base percentage being relatively low. So that has to be something that's encouraging.
Yeah, he's a really cerebral player. He knows how to play the game. He steals bases, but he's a great base runner. He's a good base stealer and a great base runner. He's a guy that goes first to third and second to home easily, and really doesn't. He's one of our guys that really doesn't need coaching on the bases, because he's such a smart heads up base runner. So he's just a good baseball player all around, and a guy that we're just seeing him scratch the surface of what he can be.
Now, Riz, I know you've been around for everything. I mean, you've seen every possible scenario in every game. But I wanted to ask you, just going back to the series in Denver and Colorado, in the first game, of course, the first game was snowed out, which is kind of nuts. But the first game of the doubleheader, or I'm sorry, it wasn't a doubleheader on Sunday, but the first game of the series on Saturday.
12-11 game?
Yeah. How are you feeling up 12-2 in the seventh? Go to the bottom of the seventh. You start bringing in some relievers. How are you feeling watching that seventh inning? I bet you were banging your head against the wall.
I've been there before. We went through it in 17 and in 15. So we've been through it before. And when you get a bullpen of new guys and trying to figure out roles and leverage situations and that type of thing, it's the early returns sometimes are ugly, and the key for us is in the bullpen is you got to throw the ball over the plate. It's that simple. This is the major leagues. If you can't throw two pitches, over the plate, and Bob Boone used to always tell me, he goes, if you can't hit a pizza pan with two pitches, you don't belong in the big leagues. And I think that it goes deep into what we're trying to do here is you can see Cole Henry comes in the game, pounds the strike zone, gets two quick outs and extinguishes a situation. So throw the ball over the plate, pound the zone, trust your stuff, and if you belong in the big leagues, you'll have success and get guys out. So but yeah, those games are they're closer than they should be, and it forces David to go to, you know, his leverage relievers when you should not have to use your leverage relievers, you know, for the games that are following. You got a doubleheader the next day. So, yeah, it's, you know, every man is important. Even though you're not pitching leverage situations or that type of thing, yeah, you have a job to do. And, you know, what we say is, everybody's a closer. You close the inning you're supposed to pitch, and you know that's the secret. And we just have to find a way. You know, guys' stuff is fine. You know, you look at the radar gun, the velocity is there, the pitch shape is there, and that type of thing. Is you have to trust the stuff to get it, to throw it over the plate and get guys out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Hey, I wanted to ask you about McKenzie because, and I know you and I talked a lot last year about this, but I mean his numbers are really. Really good in my opinion so far. He's had two 13K starts. He's got 45 strikeouts and 29 innings pitched.
We
right
started
now.
Out on fire last year,
yeah.
If I remember correctly.
He's only had one really bad start, really dicey start, and that was the game in Miami where he just got hit up a little bit. But in all of these other starts, he's not walking guys. He's striking out guys. He's keeping you guys in games. He's beat some good teams, beat the Dodgers. So talk about McKenzie in particular as compared to last year, because I know last year you said, you know what, he just has to throw strikes. He was walking too many guys last year. His velocity was good. But talk about what you think he worked on in the offseason. Is it a confidence thing, or did he work on something where he's just adjusted to it?
I think it's there's no lack of confidence with McKenzie Gore. He, okay. You know, he's got electric stuff. He knows he's got electric stuff. You know, he thinks he's pretty damn good, which he is. And I think it's a case of, you know, it's a case of when your stuff is that good, you know, he's got elite, rotation on his breaking pitches. He's got a elite movement to a very good fastball, and, his development of a good changeup is there. He's extremely athletic on the mound. All those things, you know, point to, you know, being an elite starting pitcher. And what takes you from a good starting pitcher to an elite starting pitcher is, you know, figuring out how to stay into the game, into the seventh inning. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, you have to be efficient with your pitches. And, you know, Max Scherzer used to tell me his goal, his goal was always to finish the inning with 15 pitches or less. Mm-hmm. And that's a goal that McKenzie has to have to, you know, the next step in his development is to take that elite stuff. He likes to strike out guys. He's got strikeout stuff, and take that stuff into the seventh inning with him. And once he does that, then he ascends to, you know, being this, you know, elite stuff guy to the guy who, you know, who is an elite, you know, major league starter.
Right.
And I think that's what you're seeing with his evolution.
You want to give us an update on CJ?
Yeah, CJ played last night 6 innings, I believe. He was 0 for 1 with 2 walks. He played shortstop,
okay.
Got a couple of balls there, and he'll play there tonight also. And then we'll probably make a decision and see how he feels. If he feels he needs another game or two to be on his feet, then we'll adjust from there. But he's close to being back with us.
All right, we'll get him back soon.
And we need him. That'd be great.
Oh yeah, absolutely. All right, man.
Mike, thanks as always, man. We'll talk to you again next week.
Pleasure, fellas.
Yep. Thanks for having me. That's Mike Rizzo, president and GM of the Washington Nationals, presented by Main Street Bank. Cheer local, bank local, put their team in your office. Visit mstreetbank.com for more information. When we come back, we'll get into EB's entertainment page.
B. Mitch and Finley, 106.7 The Fan, high noon in the District of Columbia. Going to the Rude Guest Hotline right now to talk to our friend Joe B. Joe Beninati. Of course, we'll be calling the action tonight along with Craig Lachlan. Caps, Habs, Game 2. Joe B., how are you, man?
JP, thanks for the Van Halen pick-me-up. I'm ready to go. Let's do this.
Joe, I will tell you, I was watching the game on the Monumental app on the other night from the pool. It was kind of nice. But they started out so good. What started well for Washington the other night?
Intensity, urgency level, just that much higher, JP and B-Mitch, because I had the sense the last month or so, 3 weeks perhaps, where the team, human nature took over, and I just thought they had the division wrapped up so soon,
yeah.
The conference wrapped up so quickly. They took their foot off the pedal. They eased up. They treated the last three weeks as if it was a prelim, and they got through it. Obviously, they achieved an amazing individual accomplishment for Alex, and now they've refocused themselves on the big prize, which is the team goal ahead. And I thought the first shift the other night in game one was awesome, and easily the Caps could have had a 2-3-goal lead in that hockey game. The fact that they didn't is troublesome. They need to bear down and bury, but you have to give Montreal's goalie Sam Montembeau some credit for that as well. But at this point in the year, now everything is past the great chase, and the chase that's in front of them is chasing 16 wins, and they've got one, and they know that their mission is far, far, far from accomplished.
Joe, your knowledge is far beyond mine, and you see way more than I see. What has to happen in this game for them to get a second victory, and what can't happen?
They need to withstand an early push tonight, B-Mitch. I think Montreal grew in confidence as the game went along. There's no way for the younger players on the Canadian side to fully replicate a Stanley Cup playoff atmosphere like Capital One Arena. A team as big and strong and as fast as Washington, you can practice all you want and think you're ready, but until you see it, it takes some time. And I thought Washington had Montreal back on its heels the first 25, 30 minutes of that game. I thought they played extremely well. Now, once that power play occurred in the third period and all of a sudden the 2-0 lead became sliced in half, momentum took over, and momentum favored the younger team in the last 10 minutes of that game. I thought the first 5 minutes or so, and Spencer Carberry confirmed that with us this morning, the first 5 minutes of the third period wasn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was the power play that happened. It was the momentum switch that comes on the Caulfield goal. And then that top line for Montreal, which arguably has been one of the best in the entire league in the last 6 weeks, they started to feel their oats. They started to attack more in waves. I just think from your question's perspective, Washington must be ready for the first 10 minutes tonight. I think you're going to see a far better Montreal team in that regard. But from a defensive standpoint for the Caps, I think what also needs to happen is what happened for the first 40 minutes of the game. The defenders, B-Mitch, directed Montreal's most dangerous players to what hockey players refer to as bad ice. Mm-hmm. You can't hurt me from out there. I've got Logan Thompson playing well. If I direct you to bad ice, odds are our defenders, our goalies are going to handle those situations. Do not let the premier offensive players from Montreal get to, quote, good ice. If that continues to happen, I like Washington's chances, especially, guys, if this remains a 5-on-5 type of game, not some game where you're going to see all of a sudden one team have 5 or 6 power plays.
Talking with our friend Joe Beninati here on the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude makes the most reliable HVAC products in the DMV. You can give Joe B. a follow at JoeBPXP. And, of course, watch on Monumental tonight as the Caps host the Canadiens, game 2 of the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Obviously, injuries are a part of this now. What did you think of Logan Thompson in his return to action in game 1?
I thought he was really sharp, JP, and I mentioned this to him. I had a conversation with him, a brief one, around his locker room stall this morning, and he said, yeah, I felt good. I felt like myself. And to which I responded to him and said, I saw the reflexive, powerful, explosive Logan Thompson of the early season, and especially at the midway mark of the season, when I don't think there was a better goalie in the league than Logan Thompson. I saw that guy in game 1 way much more than I did down the stretch. So perhaps those 6-7 games off due to the last injury that he had gave him a chance to physically and mentally reset. And I think he gained confidence from game 1, and I expect him to be even better tonight.
And where are we at with Alexi Protas getting back on the ice?
I watched him work out in the gym pretty heavily. I didn't watch the full workout, but I did see him there and pushing very, very hard. I've seen him on the ice now a couple of times, not skating full blast yet, but it looked unrestricted. And I guess from what I've been told, I wouldn't expect him tonight. although Coach Carberry wouldn't comment any further. I wouldn't really expect him maybe when the series shifts to Montreal, but at the tail end of this series, if it's a long one, if there's a 5-6-7, you may start to see him. And I think that's a great sign. How do I say this? If the Caps win tonight and have control of the series, I don't think there's any reason to rush him. Mm-hmm. I'm always conservative, JP and B. Mitch, when it comes to injuries, and especially with something regarding a hockey player's foot. I don't want Alexei Protas at 6'6 and 235 pounds playing at only 70%.
Right.
If mm-hmm. it's a do or die and you have to have him, okay, maybe. But if there's no pressing urgency, yes. Do I want him? Absolutely. I think he's the most improved player in the NHL by far. I think the Caps are way better with him. But I don't want to rush. That's just me. That's my opinion. That's always the way I behave with respect to, or want to see people behave with respect to injuries. But the doctors, the athletic trainers for the Caps, and the player himself, they know well. They'll all give Spencer the go-ahead when the right time is ahead.
Do you feel they need him going forward? Not this series, but going forward.
Carolina.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely, B. Mitch. He's too good, and they're too good with him.
Yeah.
He makes such a difference in so many different ways. You know, it's a rarity to see a player score better than 30 goals without a power play goal all season long. He doesn't get power play cookies. He had all of his goals, aside from three shorthanded goals, at even strength. He makes you that much better 5-on-5, and he will be a very good penalty killer. He will be a responsible two-way defensive player. He will be an impactful forechecker. There's so many different ways that this guy helps your squad. And I feel horribly for him that the injury happened. It's a kind of a fluky kind of thing. And at the time of the season when it does happen, there's, you know, there are so many great guys on this team, and Alexei is one of those. You root for this kind of a guy. He's easy to get your arms around. Absolutely, B. Mitch. As they progress, hopefully they take care of business against Montreal. As they move forward round from round to round, as we hope it's a long playoff push, you very much need Alexei Protas.
I think he's one of the cooler stories. Obviously, the big story this year for the Caps is Ovi. And Ovi is stories 1 through 10, right? Probably, right? But I think the development of Protas, has been... Dude, he had 6 goals last year, and this year he had 30. Now, the assist numbers jumped too, not as significantly, but he emerged as, possibly like an all-star type player, right?
Without doubt, and it's impressive, and it's a credit to the workload of the player, the work ethic, his willingness in the offseason. He's told me that he and his brother Ilya, who is a Caps draft pick, who is destroying the Ontario Hockey League right now, or I'm not sure where they are in the playoffs, but had a fantastic regular season. And, oh, by the way, I think is 6'5.5". You're going to see the Protas brothers for a long time in Washington, knock on wood. Alexei will tell you that he and Ilya were shooting day after day, working on drills, finishing shooting ability. So for the player to put in that effort and work with the coaching staff, work with the skills coaching staff, Kenny McCudden, work with all of their options to help make them better. This is a guy who works his tail off, sun up to sun down. And to see the improvement, obviously he has what you can't teach at 6'6 plus. He's NBA small forward like. Wow. Amazing. But you see him, I remember him in development camp a few years ago, and you're thinking, wow, maybe if, and all of a sudden the skating got better, and all of a sudden the hockey IQ is improving, and all of a sudden now the finishing ability is there. Now you've got a 30-goal power forward at 6'6". That's a player, man. And credit to him. He never gave up. He pushed and pushed, a la Tom Wilson, a lot like Tom Wilson, who you've seen improve over a decade. Protas is doing that same kind of arc.
Absolutely. Mm. Speaking of arc, did you see Alexiev yet today? Seeing the teeth rattling around on the ice was just unbelievable. Ugh. And these hockey guys are such tough guy maniacs that he's going to, I assume, play tonight. Like, you've called a million games, Joe. Had you ever seen teeth flying out to that level?
Yeah, I've seen it, sadly. It happens. It's part of the game. And I wince all the time for these guys because I don't know how it doesn't happen every game. You know, they're so, no pun intended, they're very heady hockey players. They're able to play with a protective eye shield. In college and junior, it's a full face shield. Tonight, you're going to see Alexiev in a full face shield. He worked this morning in a full, plexiglass shield. And I did see him at a stall. I made believe I punched him in the mouth. He wanted to kill me.
Joe, you better leave those damn hockey players alone, man.
Yeah, leave them alone. Let's just say one side of his smile is extremely empty.
It's gone.
And it's just amazing. And Dr. Lenz, all the team doctors and the caregivers for the Caps do such a great job. But from what I gather, Doc dug in right away, and they spent a good long night after game one trying to get him in a good place, and I don't think he's going to miss any time tonight. So, knock on wood, he'll be ready, and that cage won't affect his play.
If he smiles, you can see where he swallows.
You saw the picture I sent, right?
If he smiles, you can see his esophagus.
Oh, B-Mitch, it's bad. It's so bad. Oh, gosh. But all of a sudden now, you go through the year where, guys, there was a stretch where they played the same six defensemen 60 straight games. Alexiev only played 8 games in the regular season.
Dang.
They were so healthy back there for so long, and now you get little things that pop up, things that pop up with Chychrun, things that pop up. Well, unfortunately, they're taking Ferravari out for the remainder of the playoffs, but all of a sudden, you'd been so healthy for so long, you kind of cross your fingers and go, all right, maybe this injury bug is past, and let's see how far they can go.
Yeah,
The Ferravari stuff sucks. We know that he's out for the remainder. What is the latest with Chychrun?
Chychrun's good, all good, and I thought came through game one well. I think that's a lot of the season. Late in the season, a lot of the guys were dealing with minor injuries and illnesses. So many guys were sick late in the season, and that included yours truly.
Yeah, yourself included, right?
Yeah.
How are you feeling, dude?
I'm all's well, thank you. Knock on wood.
Good.
But I think we all got it right post after 8:95 celebration. Mm. I think it was all there where everybody was just feeling under the weather. I think they're past that now. Jacob's fine. Jacob took a deflected puck in the face in practice on Saturday. It's some of that's going around, but when he's right, he's such a dynamic offensive force. I love watching what he does. It's almost Panther-like, and I don't mean Florida Panther, the way he prowls around on the ice and just looks for opportunities to create odd man rushes. You, as a defender for Montreal, you're thinking, okay, it's 2-on-2. I'm good. We can defend B-Mitch and Finley here, and then all of a sudden Chychrun's in on you, and it creates problems. And that's the kind of player you need around these times.
Yeah, I can't wait. What do you think that atmosphere will be like tonight?
Awesome again.
Yeah.
They were great. They were great in game one. The Caps know it. They feel it. All the players, year after year, guys, they consistently remind us when the Caps are playing at home, the guys on the ice are like, we feel like we're less tired. There's energy there. There's always good, positive vibes coming. So you want the Caps fans to keep bringing that as many times as they can.
I bet. And Joe, how about this? All the Ovechkin goals you've covered, everything you've, you know, with Ovi throughout his career, and then that was his first ever overtime winner, right?
Yeah,
in the 44 playoffs.
44 times before he had the chance to do it, right? 44 overtime games he had played before he pots one, and it just tells you how rare it is to have one of those go for you. And there are some guys who gravitate towards it and have had numerous instances. It's not like Ovi didn't have his chances in those first 44 games.
Yeah.
And his playoff goal numbers are terrific and such. But for that to be his first one to end the game, it was pretty cool. And obviously you saw him celebrate like a madman. And he's been just on fire down the stretch here. I can't tell you the difference between last season when he expended so much energy to help the Caps get into the playoffs. I don't think he had much, and he may have been dealing with other issues when Washington was beaten by New York in the first round last year. this year, flying home the way he has to the all-time record and continuing his pace. He just looks like he's moving well, and that's the one where you really got to cross your fingers and hope that if a 39-year-old player with his kind of gumption stays healthy, man, we can go places.
Anybody looking for motivation, just look at him.
Spectacular stuff.
Anybody on that team, I'm telling you, like, if you start thinking, oh, I'm a little tired, look at that dude. He's been there over 20 years plus, and he's still doing it that high. You can't. You don't have time.
that's called leading by example, B-Mitch. That's totally what it is.
For sure. Joe, nobody's looking ahead. The game is tonight, focused on that, then two in Montreal, whatever happens. They're playing some pretty damn good hockey down in Raleigh. Has that crossed your eye?
Oh, I absolutely see it, and I know it, and you want there to be a Caps matchup in the second round with whomever, if it's Carolina or Jersey, but I think most people would have predicted Carolina, and by no means is Washington out of the first round. They got to play well tonight, especially, sure, guys, because Montreal only gets better at Bell Center, and the atmosphere that's phenomenal at D.C. goes to another level, if you can believe it, when it goes almost 22,000 strong in Montreal.
Damn, I bet.
So they're going to be tough to beat. If Washington does, as the favorite, get through this round and you set up a matchup with Carolina, yeah, don't get too far ahead of yourself. But the Canes are a terrific team, and that would be a wonderful matchup. But one step at a time, you've got a very good Montreal team in front of you, and you need to be at your best to beat them. So focus on that first. But, yeah, the fan in me, the media person in me sitting there going, that round two could be great. Yeah, I understand that part,
Joe,
but let's see what you do with Montreal.
Absolutely. Last thing for me. I can't help but notice the Caps have two French-Canadian dudes.
Yeah.
Dubois and Beauvillier. Hopefully I'm saying that close to correct. What do you think it means for those guys to get to go play playoff hockey back in Montreal?
It's special. And Anthony Beauvillier has had some terrific playoff experiences in odd circumstances. One of them was in a bubble during the COVID experience. But when you look at his playoff numbers, he's the kind of player who provides at this time. And then with regard to Pierre-Luc Dubois, both of them, obviously growing up in hockey-mad Quebec, it's especially great for them to return home and play in the hardest tournament to win in sports. And both of those guys know and accept at the beginning of a series like this that there's going to be a lot of media impacting them because they're bilingual. And it was amazing to watch the media crush here in D.C. And then when the series shifts, when we head up there tomorrow and you see the game for game three on Friday, the amount of media, print media, TV, radio, you name it, it's consuming.
Right, crazy.
And those guys obviously are sought out because they can speak French.
I bet. I didn't even think about it. You know what I think might help them is how crazy the media situation has been around the Ovi series, around the Ovi goals. When I was waiting in Long Island, when we were waiting to get in the locker room after Ovi scored 895, there was a Montreal crew next to me that I was kind of talking to. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of talking S, actually. He's like, have you seen how good the Canadiens are playing? I was like, I'm not worried about the Canadiens, buddy. But they went after, now that you bring that up, they went after those guys in the locker room. I'm sure that'll be another level of intensity. Yeah.
I used this expression earlier. I mean, it's like you're going to Yankee Stadium. It's like you're going to Lambeau Field. Mm-hmm. You pick it. You pick the analogy. Mm-hmm. It's religion there, and it's the number one topic from sunrise to sunset.
There you go. Joe B., thank you for time, man. Have a great call tonight.
Guys, my pleasure. Thanks very much. See you on Monumental Sports.
Yes, sir. It's our friend Joe Beninati, Caps Canadiens Game 2 tonight. You can listen to it right here on 106.7 The Fan. John Walton on the call. That means you can listen to Nats Orioles on Team 980. You can watch the Caps game on Monumental Sports Network. Here, Joe B. and Locker. Get a dub tonight. Let's talk about how confident we feel in the Washington Capitals when we return.